Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Medical Update on Pancreatic Cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in the topic that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 643 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions. And we also have participants from Canada, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is information about the topics that are going to be covered today, the speakers, and also about all of the different collaborating organizations and their resource information so that you can use them for yourself in terms of getting help. In addition, there is an evaluation form, and I'm going to ask all of you to please complete that form. When you think about it, you are all the very best people to tell us what these programs should contain, what topics we should cover going forward, and what our focus should be. So we very much appreciate your feedback and your suggestions. Indeed, this program today is one that many of you have requested repeatedly, and so we're offering this program and hope to offer this again later on in the year as well. Today's program has been made possible by a grant from Celgene, and I really want to thank them for their support to this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on the program today, and I want to begin by introducing our very first speaker, Dr. Eileen O'Reilly. And Dr. O'Reilly is Associate Attending, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Associate Professor, Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. O'Reilly is going to address an overview of pancreatic cancer, current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and clinical trials. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. O'Reilly.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm going to walk you through a little bit about the background and epidemiology and risk factors for pancreas cancer, discuss where surgery may be an appropriate consideration versus medical treatments, and then discuss some of the current standard treatments and emerging therapies in pancreas cancer, along with reviewing some background on clinical trials. So in North America, this is a relatively common cancer. About 45,000 people will be diagnosed this year. And on a worldwide basis, it's estimated that over 200,000 will be diagnosed. And pancreas cancer is actually a rising public health problem because it's one of the cancers that has the distinction of having rising incidence rates that have been demonstrated a pretty steady increase over the last couple of decades. And that speaks to, you know, why do people get pancreas cancer? And there are a few recognized factors, being older in life is one. The average age at diagnosis is in the early 70s, and the risk does increase significantly after the age of 50. People who have a significant tobacco history that's current or recent have a higher risk of developing pancreas cancer. There are certain dietary attributions that have been associated with the risk of this disease, although they are somewhat controversial. People who have long-standing chronic inflammation in the pancreas, people of long-standing diabetes have a slightly higher risk factor for developing this cancer, and people who have chronic hepatitis C or B infections and possibly other viral infections. But in truth, for most people, we really don't fully understand why they get this cancer. And I should say that there's another important contribution in terms of risk, which comes from our genetics or DNA makeup in terms of what genes run in the family that can predispose to pancreas cancer. And in that regard, there are several well-defined, relatively uncommon genetic syndromes that are associated with pancreas cancer. And perhaps one of the most well-known ones is the hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndrome, which has gotten some publicity recently from Angelina Jolie and her presentation about her own personal background of carrying a BRCA gene change. So not only are those BRCA gene changes associated with breast and ovary cancer, but they're also associated with pancreas cancer. And the importance there is that there are families where these genes are identified, where pancreas cancer may be present, where there is a consideration for screening for selected families that are deemed to be at higher risk for this disease. There are certain other conditions. Another example is hereditary pancreatitis, which occurs from certain gene changes that cause chronic inflammation and destruction in the pancreas. That's rare, but associated with a high lifetime risk of pancreas cancer. And then a more common but still rare in the genetic sense syndrome is called HNPCC, which can associate colon polyps and a family history of colon, endometrial, or bladder or other malignancies with pancreas cancer. And again, the importance is identifying these families and seeing whether healthy members of these families are appropriate for consideration of screening, recognizing it that at this time screening is not a proven strategy, but in selected people may well have a role. So going on to the more clinical aspects of this disease, for many people it comes to light with some relatively non-specific symptoms, so change in appetite, feeling full, sometimes abdominal or back discomfort. Often for tumors that arise in the head of the pancreas, people will notice the urine getting dark, they're starting to itch, and they or the family will notice that they're getting jaundiced. And that's a well-recognized presentation for pancreas cancer. Other things that people can notice can be a change in the bowel habits, where they begin to sort of malabsorb what they're eating, or that they've become diabetic, or recently there's been a change in terms of their diabetic control. Tumors that arise in the left side of the pancreas, that's the body and tail there, the less common locations, sometimes abdominal or back pain can be a major feature of the presentation. And a smaller proportion of people will come to light with clots, presenting with either a clot in the leg called a diffuse thrombosis or even a clot in the lung called a pulmonary embolus. And a workup for those symptoms can lead to, in a small number of people, the identification of pancreas cancer. And just to make sure we're all focused on the same topic, we're talking today primarily about adenocarcinoma of the pancreas, which is the most common type of pancreas cancer. But to recognize that there are another group of pancreas malignancies called neuroendocrine cancers of the pancreas and some other rare subtypes, which for the most part have a different background, sometimes different presentation, and certainly different implications in terms of treatment and outcomes. So when we're evaluating a person with a new diagnosis of pancreas cancer, the first step is to make that diagnosis, and one has a lot of hints from the clinical symptoms, from blood tests, and the next step is usually high-quality imaging, which can include a dedicated pancreas CAT scan, which will look in detail at a tumor in the pancreas, its relation to blood vessels, and whether or not they're spread beyond the local area, in particular looking at the liver and the inner lining of the abdominal cavity and the lungs, which are the main areas that pancreas cancer can go to. For people who have jaundice, that's usually relieved by putting in a stent or a little pipe, typically a metal stent, into the bile duct, and that relieves the jaundice and can relieve the itching and return color to normal. And at the same time, or in a parallel assessment, an endoscopic ultrasound like an upper endoscopy can be performed, and one can visualize directly the pancreas and place a little needle in and obtain a sample of the tumor to secure the diagnosis. And these days we're trying even to do a little more than that. We're trying to see if we can obtain additional tissue for molecular studies, which may have an impact in terms of how we would choose to treat the cancer subsequently. That's not prime time yet, but that's a sort of a new direction in pancreas cancer treatments. So there are three overall groups of patients that we think about, people who have localized pancreas cancer that hasn't spread to other areas and that doesn't involve key blood vessels. And in that context, a typical treatment approach would be to take that individual to surgery. And for tumors that are in the head of the pancreas, that individual would undergo a Whipple surgery, which is a major operation, involves taking out the head of the pancreas, typically the gallbladder, and rejoining up the pancreas to the bowel. Sometimes part of the stomach is removed, and part of the small bowel, the duodenum, is also taken out. That operation takes typically 7 to 9 days in the hospital, and then a recuperation period of anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks for the majority of people. For people with a successful operation, we routinely recommend post-operative treatment. That's called adjuvant treatment, and that typically consists of chemotherapy, medicines given into the vein that are designed to address any microscopic cells that they could be lurking either in the area where the pancreatic tumor was or indeed any other area in the body but may not necessarily be visualized on imaging. And the goals of that treatment are to try and maximize the chances of the cancer not coming back. A second grouping of this disease is what's called locally advanced or inoperable pancreas cancer, or another term is stage 3, meaning that it's involving key blood vessels. And at least at the time of the initial assessment, the cancer is not deemed eligible for surgery. And the initial strategies would be designed to try and stop metastases turning up and to try and see if it's possible to shrink the tumor, in particular to shrink it away from blood vessels, and see if it's possible at a later time point to address an operation, recognizing that that's not true for a majority of people who have stage 3 disease, but it certainly is true for a percentage, and that's always a goal that we have in mind when we meet people that fall into that context. And then perhaps the largest grouping of people that we meet have evidence of spread of the cancer beyond the pancreas itself, either involving the liver, the lining of the abdominal cavity, or the lungs. And in these settings, we do not recommend surgery or radiation. The primary treatment is medical treatment designed to stop the cancer growing, to shrink it as much as possible, and to try and extend life as best we can, and at the same time maximizing quality of life, because that's a very important balance that my colleagues will speak to in a couple of minutes. And to introduce just the concept of treatment for pancreas cancer, which is spread, just to mention here what a clinical trial is. There are a series of clinical trials. There are what we call late-stage clinical trials, which are comparing a new medication to a standard. And then there are earlier trials like a phase 1 study where we're looking at what's the best dose of a medication, what's the best schedule to administer that drug with, and to look to see is there early evidence of activity that might cause one to go on to do a bigger assessment in a more restricted group of people to more fully understand the signal in terms of activity and side effects. And the results from that type of middle stage trial, a phase 2 study, would usually determine whether or not the signal is strong enough to go on to develop a phase 3 trial, which is a late stage clinical trial, and that's usually a trial that's trying to change the standard of care. So to mention a couple of treatments for metastatic pancreas cancer, two main considerations would be a combination of medications called FOLFIRINOX, which involves many of our favorite drugs in GI oncology, including 5-FU, a medication called oxaliplatin, a vitamin called leucovorin, and 5-FU. And for fit people with pancreas cancer, this is high up on our list of treatment considerations. An emerging treatment consideration is based on a late-stage phase 3 trial that was presented earlier this year and will be updated at the American Society of Clinical Oncology next week, which is our major oncology meeting, will support a combination of gemcitabine and a drug called albumin-bound paclitaxel, or nab-paclitaxel, or also known as Abraxane. And that particular combination is likely to become increasingly utilized as part of treatment for pancreas cancer. And in fact, a series of clinical trials are building on that backbone and adding new medications to try and improve, indeed, even on the outcomes of that particular combination. So it's nice to see exciting news in pancreas cancer, and I think the field is encouraged for patients and families that we will hopefully have another treatment option to add for this disease. So I'll stop there and pass the microphone back to Carolyn and Dr. Javly. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. O'Reilly, for just a wonderful presentation and introduction and overview of pancreatic cancer, and also for your being very informative and comprehensive, just really excellent. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And also for the helpfulness in terms of new treatments that are becoming available. This is really important as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Milan Javly, and Dr. Javly is Associate Professor, Department of Gastrointestinal GI Medical Oncology, Division of Cancer Medicine, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Javly is going to address pain and symptom management, communicating with your healthcare team, quality of life concerns, and managing weight loss. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Javly.
Thank you, Carolyn. Pancreas cancer is one of those where pain is a significant issue. I would say, a majority of patients at some point in the trajectory of this illness. The causes of pain in pancreas cancer are multifactorial, but it is believed to be, for the most part, secondary to the cancer itself, involving nerves surrounding lymph nodes that go towards arteries, particularly the celiac artery. So the typical pain is in the upper mid-abdominal area and then radiates to the back. There are, of course, other pain syndromes, such as pain that arises from neuropathy as a complication of treatment, pain that arises secondary to constipation, or discomfort in the upper abdomen as a result of indigestion. The mainstay of therapy for in terms of pain management is systemic, that is, medications administered either orally or topically in the form of patches, such as opioids and narcotics. These are extremely effective in management of moderate and even severe pain related to the cancer. However, interventional procedures such as blocks can be extremely valuable in patients who have refractory pain or who are intolerant to systemic or oral narcotics. The WHO several years ago had initiated a stepladder approach for management of pain, which is effective even today. And it consists of three basic steps. For mild pain, we use non-narcotics such as acetaminophen, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen for management of pain. And as the pain severity increases, then we use first milder narcotics such as hydrocodone, oxycodone, and then subsequently on the third step of the ladder, more stronger narcotics such as morphine and hydromorphone. At any point in the step ladder, the pain medication that is used is not used in isolation. In other words, we often add other adjuvant medications to it, such as acetaminophen, such as non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, as well as nerve blocking agents or drugs that are useful for alleviating nerve pain. It must be borne in mind that pain medications are associated with significantly high incidence of constipation, and that by itself can lead to severe pain and emergency room visits. So we monitor the GI side effects or gastrointestinal side effects of narcotic pain medications very carefully. And in fact, in my practice, I prophylactically administer laxative medications to patients who are on strong narcotics because inevitably this will be an issue during treatment. The term nerve block is used quite broadly, but it basically involves a needle and an injection to deliver an agent for the purpose of pain control. These are used not commonly, but they are used, as I mentioned earlier, for refractory pain that does not respond well to narcotics, or patients who just do not tolerate pain medications well. And the most commonly used one is called celiac plexus neurolysis, and it consists of an injection that is administered radiologically or endoscopically, that is under the guidance of an X-ray or through an endoscope. And the injection is the medication is, which is typically a narcotic and an anesthetic, is injected directly into the nerve surrounding the celiac plexus, or the main nerve supply arising from the pancreas. The duration of relief can be variable, but it can vary from 1 month to sometimes 6 months, and it often depends on the underlying course of the disease. There are several other technologies that are useful for pain control, for instance, trigger point injection, as well as some non-pharmacological or non-interventional approaches, such as meditation, yoga, relaxation techniques. They all serve to improve the overall health and well-being of the patient. And it must not be forgotten that for optimal pain relief, the underlying cancer has to be under good control. So often patients who present with severe pain secondary to the cancer, when they initiate on a therapy such as Dr. O'Reilly described, and the therapy is effective, that itself results in alleviation of pain. Also for radiation, which is typically used for more advanced cancers that are involving the nerve plexus, radiation therapy can be quite effective in controlling pain. Let me move on to some other symptoms that our patients commonly present with. One of them is early satiety or bloating, and this symptom often arises from secondary to indigestion. So pancreas is, as you know, all know, an important digestive organ. And when the cancer involves the main pancreatic duct, digestion is impaired, particularly digestion of fat and complex carbohydrates. And that results in a feeling of bloating, indigestion, abdominal discomfort, and in fact even pain, particularly after eating. In that case, we often prescribe pancreatic enzymes. These enzymes have to be titrated depending on the nutritional intake, depending on often the severity of the cancer. And they're often administered concurrently with proton pump inhibitors, or medications that are used to alleviate gastric acidity, and can be remarkably effective in controlling some of the bloating and indigestion. When the cancer is advanced, so it typically becomes typically in stage 3 or sometimes stage 4, it can surround the neck of the stomach, as it were, and produce a syndrome of gastric outlet obstruction. And in these situations, the patient can present with vomiting, abdominal pain, abdominal bloating, even after very modest amounts of food intake. And in these situations, there are really no medications or enzymes that can be useful. It requires intervention, such as surgical bypass, or more commonly a stent placed in the duodenum in the first part of the small intestine. Another syndrome that can cause early satiety besides the indigestion or actual obstruction is a syndrome of gastroparesis, or slowing of the stomach. So the nerves that supply the stomach are often arising around the pancreas, and when the pancreas cancer is involving those nerves, the stomach just does not contract to release the food down into the intestine. And the stomach, as it were, becomes slow. In such conditions, we often prescribe a specific form of diet, which involves low fiber, low residue, softer liquid foods, as well as prokinetic agents, or agents that are useful for accelerating the motility of the stomach. One commonly used one is metoclopramide, and in Canada, a medication called domperidone may be useful in that situation. Other GI symptoms that patients often notice with pancreas cancer are severe diarrhea in the early stages when there's malabsorption. And again, in this situation, appropriate dietary control, although patients can lose weight, I often counsel them to reduce their fat intake, because fat is digested primarily in the stomach and mediated by the pancreatic enzymes, as well as reduce their intake of complex carbohydrates and sugars, which often can lead to diarrhea and indigestion. Enzymes are also extremely effective in controlling diarrhea that results from malabsorption from pancreatic cancer. Constipation that can result from narcotics can sometimes result from nausea medications which are administered prior to chemotherapy or from cancer itself can be a severe and debilitating symptom in patients with pancreas cancer. So we prescribe sometimes a combination of laxatives, such as one, a bulk forming laxative, which provides a large amount of fiber, as well as an agent that causes irritation, such as which can cause increase the stomach motility. I always encourage a generous amount of fluids in order to make sure that the patients don't get bound up with constipation. So the other most common symptom that occurs in patients with pancreas cancer at early earlier in their course is jaundice. And as mentioned earlier, there is really no pharmacological or drug type of intervention that can help in that situation. That requires a tube placement either internally, called an internal stent through an ERCP, or sometimes in exceptional situations externally, where a tube is placed outside through the abdominal wall to drain into a bag called the percutaneous drainage of the biliary tract. Let me move on to communication between patients and their providers, which is healthcare, no less important, than other aspects of life. It is shown by several studies that improved communication between patients and providers has a significant impact on patient satisfaction and actually a positive impact on their health outcomes. There are limitations in these communications, unfortunately. These are limitations sometimes by the kind of role that physicians and patients are unfortunately made to assume in the clinic, where patients often sometimes assume a more passive role, whereas the physicians and the providers are in a more dominant relationship, and whereas it should be a more of a partnership, which is mutually beneficial for the optimal care of the patients. Within the constraints of clinic time, this can be a challenge for the clinical provider alone. So there are several resources that are available to patients and their caregivers. For instance, discussing during the clinic time. For instance, we make electronic communication quite easy at MD Anderson. In most instances, we encourage their participation in support groups with patients, their caregivers, nursing staff. We also often have actively engaged social workers who are engaged in communicating the patient needs both directly to the patients as well as the healthcare team. In I have to say, even as clinicians, we have to be more mindful about engaging ourselves and trying to understand the patient characteristics and getting to know the patient as a person and not necessarily as someone who has pancreas cancer. This is we remain mindful in that regard, but of course there are limitations, and I think there is work to be done from the provider point of view. Let me discuss a little about quality of life. I think I hear this almost every clinic from at least one patient. When they mention that they are faced with a diagnosis such as metastatic pancreas cancer, that often the patients are interested in quality of life so that they can enjoy with their children and their families and grandchildren, and not necessarily quantity, if that quantity is going to be limited and full of toxicities secondary to treatments and the cancer itself. And I think it's important in these instances that we that the patients communicate their desires directly to the providers so that even their therapy can be optimized as per the individual needs of the patient. For instance, there are some combinations that are being commonly used now, such as FOLFIRINOX, which can be extremely beneficial, can improve patients' quality of life. But if they are used in a less than judicious fashion, they can impair quality of life, lead to considerable weight loss, lead to toxicities, and certainly a direct line of communication between patient expectations and the provider expectations is essential to prevent any discord in that regard. And the final point I'd like to make about is in this cancer is management of weight loss. So pancreas, as we all know, is a digestive organ. It is responsible for digestion of important nutrients such as carbohydrates and fats. And it is almost given that this digestion is impaired and therefore can lead to weight loss. Weight loss can occur because of several other issues such as toxicities of treatment, nausea resulting from chemotherapy or radiation, constipation from narcotic pain medication, and even depression that often occurs secondary to the cancer. So I often counsel my patients first by telling them that it is not that we are aiming towards a target weight. It's not that we want them to necessarily gain weight. We want them to feel well and be able to enjoy the things that they do. But while having said that, there are some sensible measures that can be undertaken in order to prevent progressive weight loss and maintain patients' state of nutrition. I almost always have a nutritionist such as Diana, who you will hear from, engaged actively in the patient's care so that they can counsel patients upon regarding appropriate foods, regarding avoiding certain food items that might lead to discomfort, such as, for instance, a large amount of fatty or fried foods, adequate intake of enzymes, adequate control of pain, maintaining adequate hydration. These common sense, simple measures often work, not necessarily always in gaining weight, but preventing progressive weight loss. Patients often question whether there are medications that can be useful for weight prevention or of weight loss or actually leading to weight gain. And there are some. I have to make a disclaimer that none of them are particularly wonderful. And several of them have side effects. For instance, a commonly used derivative of progesterone, megestrol, is often prescribed to patients. And it can work. However, it can lead to high blood sugars. It leads to a high risk of blood clots. And its success rate is about 20-30%, so not everybody actually benefits. There is a medication which is a derivative of cannabis or a medicinal form of marijuana, which is also modestly helpful. But again, it is not as not beneficial. It's really not particularly beneficial in patients who have progressive cancer or who are not adequately being treated for pain management, constipation, and enzyme supplementation. So this is a quick summary of symptom and management issues. This concludes my remarks, Carolyn.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Jeffley. That was really a really fantastic, actually a very wonderful overview of all the different types of symptoms and how they can be managed. I know that for many people on the call, this is so important to get this information, so I can't thank you enough. And I know there'll be questions to you during the Q&A. And also, I think what's really helpful to hear is that the medical profession is really interested in each person as a person, in addition to their pancreas cancer, which is really very very helpful to hear and understand. So thank you. Our next speaker is Diana Bearden. Diana is a clinical nutrition. She supervises clinical nutrition at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Diana is going to address nutritional concerns and eating tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Diana, who's pretty much on all of our teleconferences on pancreas cancer. So I welcome you here, Diana, and we look forward to your comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn. Hi, everyone. I'm excited to discuss some of the concerns that we face nutritionally with the patients who come to us with pancreas cancer and helping support them during their treatment. So to start with, side effects from pancreas cancer and then the treatments related to the cancer, have it be from surgery or radiation or even chemotherapy, can affect your nutritional status and your intake. These treatments can increase your nutritional needs and may require the use of the pancreatic enzymes that we've heard several times today, which has been very helpful, and or diet modifications may be required. The main goal, though, is eating well during your treatment can provide you the energy to do the things you enjoy, as well as maintain your weight and your muscle mass, which is very important. Patients that maintain good nutrition tend to tolerate treatments better and have a faster recovery from their side effects. Weight loss and diarrhea are common side effects that I see a lot with patients whenever we're looking at addressing some of the nutritional concerns. They come to me, and these are the two main things I see patients struggling with. The main reason we see weight loss, like Dr. Jovely mentioned, is related to a decrease in the food intake. This may be related to nausea, maybe a poor appetite, the feeling of fullness, the experiencing indigestion. Also, malabsorption, which has been touched upon with utilizing the pancreatic enzymes to help improve the absorption of those nutrients. Excessive weight loss can cause treatment delays, breaks in treatment, and slow the healing process. So it's very important that, like Dr. Jovely mentioned, you know, working with your healthcare team and communicating with them, letting them know some of the challenges you're facing so they can help nip these in the bud early on and reduce any weight loss, additional weight loss that can occur if it goes untreated. So maintaining your weight and your lean muscle mass are very important. And in order to accomplish this, you need to be consuming enough calories and protein in your diet so that your body can utilize what you're eating for the energy it needs to get through your day-to-day activities and through the treatment. Meeting with your dietitian can help you see really what your goals are, know your nutritional goals for your calorie and protein intake and your fluid intake. This can change throughout the course of your treatment. So, like was mentioned earlier, you know, keeping in communication with your team, each treatment, even the progression of the treatment can have a new set of issues that come up and they're put on the table that you need to potentially change your plan to best serve your needs. But as we look at your diet, so the main components of the diet we're focusing on are obviously the calories. You know, calories are what we are utilizing to give us the energy to do the things that we need to do. Now, calories can come from several places. They come from carbohydrates, fat, and protein. Each one of these components is very important in maintaining a well-balanced diet. It may just be that we adjust the amount that you're taking in based on where you are and the experiences that you're going through. But to help meet your calorie needs, it may be necessary to break it into small, frequent meals, especially if you're struggling with maintaining your weight or being able to eat as much as you did at one other point based on some of the side effects you might be experiencing, such as feeling of fullness, even the nausea, sometimes indigestion. So breaking it into small, frequent meals, whatever it takes for you to reach your nutritional goals. Now, foods can also be fortified to add more calories since you are going to be eating smaller amounts potentially. Your dietitian can go through with you some of the options that are out there and look at healthy options as well. A lot of times patients, are also very concerned about the nutritional benefit of their food. So the dietitian can help explain that to you and then give you those appropriate suggestions to reach your goals. Protein is another component of our caloric intake, and protein helps protect your lean muscle mass and aids in healing. It's very important. The protein that you eat, your body can use for energy, therefore sparing the lean muscle mass. And it's important because lean muscle mass is what gives us the strength to do things. And if you've ever lost a lot of weight at one time, you might notice that, gosh, I'm feeling a little bit more flabby. I don't have that muscle tone I used to have. A lot of times that can be related to your body utilizing that muscle mass for energy. And so what we want to do is prevent that from happening as much as we can. So by eating enough calories by mouth, it will direct your body to use what you're eating for energy rather than utilizing your lean muscle stores. And the protein that you eat, like I said, can also help with healing, wound healing. It's very important, especially if you're going through any treatment such as surgery or radiation, for example. Those can be very damaging to tissue, and so protein is a building block for healing those areas that need to be addressed. So good sources of protein include things like eggs, dried beans, dairy products, and meat. There are also vegetarian options for protein sources, such as I mentioned the beans, but also, there's tofu, there's ways to make complete proteins from complex carbohydrates, and then our lentils and our beans. So if you follow certain diet restrictions, then we can always make it work for each patient. Protein supplements can also be purchased to help increase protein intake. You may see some of these on the market. However, I caution everybody to please discuss these products with your healthcare team. A lot of times it's hard to decipher what else has been added to the product, and especially if you're going through treatment, there are some things that we like to consider whenever a patient's going through treatment to not interfere with that treatment. So always run products by your healthcare team so that everyone's on the same page. Adequate fluid is also very important, and hydration is something that is very powerful, actually. Dehydration can increase nausea, can actually, make you feel really crummy. It can also result in fatigue. You can even have headaches and feel dizzy if you're dehydrated. And just to remember, fluid is anything that's liquid at room temperature. So these are things like water, even sports drinks. Sometimes you might be directed to an electrolyte replacement option. Be aware, and hydration is something that is we can sense early on if we're becoming dehydrated. Just the simple side effect of a feeling thirsty, that's our body's first initial, hi, we're thirsty, we need some more hydration, so please give us some fluid. That can be a very simple way, and then as the hydration status deteriorates, then you can start experiencing some of those other things I mentioned, such as nausea and headaches and feeling dizzy. Also, becoming dehydrated can result, it's very serious, can result in some electrolyte abnormalities. So if you're experiencing diarrhea, vomiting, or you are not taking in enough fluid, which you can speak with your dietitian and your healthcare team about how much fluid you need to take in a day, you need to let them know, because this can, like I said earlier, some side effects, and if they progress, they can interfere with the progression of your treatment. So it's very, very important that you let everyone know. Something that is very helpful, not only for the patient but for the healthcare team, is keeping a daily food record. And I say it's very helpful for everyone because it helps the patient acknowledge what they're actually eating. Sometimes when we don't feel well, we're like, goodness, I've eaten so much. But when you write it down, you really kind of see that black and white, wow, this is really all I've eaten today. It can also help if you're having side effects and issues. When you bring in this information to your healthcare team, they can help target ways to maybe manipulate what you're eating, or maybe add or subtract something that is part of your medications. And it really is very, very helpful. Reading labels, knowing how many calories you're taking in. And these are things, here at Anderson, we have great calorie resources. We give patients booklets that'll have calorie and protein and fat information in them, so patients are empowered to know where they need to be and make the choices to accomplish their goals and have that independence. So, like I mentioned earlier, a lot of times during treatment, diet modifications might be necessary, and this can be due to the disease process, or it could even be just a response to side effect management, maybe from a surgery or radiation or chemotherapy. And so, like we mentioned a little earlier, and Dr. Jovely mentioned this, about using the pancreatic enzymes, that's one way we can modify your care, but also potentially reducing the amount of fat in your diet. You know, like I mentioned earlier, eating small, frequent meals. And diarrhea is a very common side effect. And there's a lot of reasons we can have diarrhea, so it's not just one reason. Now, Dr. Jovely mentioned several things, and one thing that we talk about from a nutrition perspective is foods that can actually aggravate your system and result in diarrhea. So foods that can exacerbate the situation are foods that are high in fat. And this is good fat and bad fat. This is where sometimes it gets a little confusing for patients. But at a point of digestion, if you're eating an avocado, which is very high in healthy fat, you can still have the same result digestive-wise if you were to eat a Double Mac cheeseburger. So it's not about the type of fat all the time. Obviously, we want you to eat the healthy fat, but it's about modifying the amount that you're eating and then coupling it with the appropriate enzymes if that's indicated. So sauces and gravies are also ways that fat is sort of hidden in our diet. So being aware of those items, if you're having diarrhea, can be a place to start. Insoluble fiber. Now, there's insoluble fibers in a lot of our foods as well as soluble fiber. But insoluble fiber are things like, you know, celery. You can see that fiber that is very, very strong, and no matter how long you cook a food item, it still looks like it did when you put it in there. So celery is a good example of that. Even the skins on our fruits and vegetables, those are considered insoluble fiber. This type of fiber actually is a bulking agent, but can also exacerbate diarrhea if you're eating a large amount of it. So, you know, being aware of that. Other things that can exacerbate the diarrhea are foods that are high in sugar or concentrated sweets. This covers the spectrum from fruit juice all the way to cakes, candies, cookies, pies. So, again, it's about moderation and realizing your response to those foods. Another item that a lot of times can be overlooked in the diet are sugar alcohols, and these can be found in sugar-free foods. They can actually result in an exacerbation of the diarrhea as well. So what can you eat? Foods that can actually help reduce some of the symptoms of the diarrhea are things that are lower in fat, so you know, things that are baked and broiled rather than fried, and eating more foods in its natural form. And what I mean by that is not putting a lot of sauces and gravies and dipping your food in different dipping sauces. That can be another source for a high fat, and it sometimes isn't an obvious addition, but it can be one of the things that we want to reduce. Also, increasing the amount of soluble fiber. So earlier I said to be aware of the amount of insoluble fiber, but the counterpart to that is soluble fiber. And soluble fiber is kind of like a sponge. I always look at it like a sponge, because when we eat soluble fiber and it goes through our system, it actually pulls water, and it can help slow down the transit time of the food as it goes through our digestive tract. So it can help kind of pull those items together, so you're not having those bouts of diarrhea with a lot of fluid. The soluble fiber kind of acts, like I said, as a sponge. And foods that have a higher amount of soluble fiber are things like bananas and applesauce and oats. So oatmeal you know, is a great thing to add to your diet. We also look at different types of breads potentially that we want to talk with the dietitian about that, because it's about picking the right types of items. But that's another source of soluble fiber. And again, you know, sometimes small frequent meals are important just based on what the cause of the diarrhea is. A lot of times we can have a big surgery and there may be a change in your anatomy resulting in a change in the way your body processes the food. So small frequent meals may be something we, you know, may be indicated. So if you're experiencing things like frequent stooling or floating stools, foul-smelling stools, you may need pancreatic enzymes. Our body, like Dr. Jawley says, normally produces these items, but when there's an insult, this may be compromised. And so enzyme replacement is something to definitely talk about with your healthcare team. These enzymes are important, like Dr. Jawley mentioned, with breaking down carbohydrates and fats, as well as proteins. There are some enzymes that break down proteins as well. And the reason why it's important is because if they're not broken down, they can't be absorbed into your bloodstream. So it's kind of like I tell patients, it's kind of like a bowling ball. If they're never broken down, they kind of tumble down our digestive tract, and we lose that potential for nutritional absorption. So that's where enzymes become very important. And these enzymes are mimicking what our body would normally produce. So it's a very organic thing to have added to your diet if your body's not able to produce enough of it on its own or access it to your digestive system. So just to conclude as a final point, Rena, remember your main goal is to maintain your weight and your lean muscle mass during your treatment course. If you've lost a lot of weight or you're challenged with that, talk with your healthcare team to work out a plan to best meet your needs. Always be in open communication and look for your treatment team to be your support. Thank you for allowing me to be part of this workshop, and I'll pass the line back over to Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Diana, for just a wonderful presentation and really so many helpful tips to everybody in terms of food and what to eat and pancreatic enzymes and just really lots of information. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra. Liz is an oncology social worker, and she's program coordinator for pancreatic cancer at Cancer Care. And Liz is going to address the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care, as well as the important role of support groups. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my colleague and friend, Liz Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with pancreatic cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs, including individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help and some limited financial assistance, as well as chemo copay assistance, are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustments, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through similar situations or have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a pancreatic cancer support group over the telephone for both patients and caregivers, as well as a specific online group for caregivers for people with pancreatic cancer. We have unique young adult caregiver groups as well. If you are interested in any of the cancer care services, please call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or visit us at our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you will find a lot of information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you need to receive. As we learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you may want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Liz, and thanks for explaining to everybody about the services and the importance of groups. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. So, Stephanie, could you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions, and let's see how many questions we can take. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Deva M. Your line is open.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity to speak with all of you. And my question's a little bit out of the topic. I was diagnosed with malignant insulinoma with NET liver mets, and I would like to know if you could recommend the best facility in the country where I may go, where they've had the most experience and can help me navigate this health challenge.
Dr. O'Reilly, could you address this in a general way? And we hope you'll take this back to your treating healthcare team, Dana. Yes.
Sure. So the question, where might be the best centers in terms of management of neuroendocrine cancer involving the liver? Well, I think it's hard to recommend one specific place above another, but I would say any of the large comprehensive cancer centers would be an excellent resource to tap into. And typically, we approach, you know, this disease with multiple disciplines from the perspective of medical oncology, interventional radiology, surgery, and gastroenterology as to what would be the best options to treat this particular type of cancer with liver-involved disease.
Excellent. Thank you. And thank you, Dana. Thank you. And our next question?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press the star then one key on your touchtone telephone.
And there's a question actually from one of our online participants, from Laura. Would you recommend an endoscopic ultrasound for surveillance for someone with a BRCA1 genetic mutation and first 2 degree relatives who have had pancreatic cancer? Dr. O'Reilly, could you address that in a general way?
Yes, so that's a very good question. So the BRCA genes, as we discussed earlier, may be associated with an increased risk of developing pancreas cancer. And in families where there are other members of the family who've had pancreas cancer and where these genes are present, we do indeed think about screening. And this is done in the context of carefully designed approaches to patients or indeed healthy people, where the considerations can include scanning, which is usually with an MRI scan and very dedicated imaging of the pancreas. And if a finding is seen on a scan, that can prompt an endoscopic ultrasound or a direct endoscopy to look at the pancreas more directly. That
isn't necessarily the primary tool, the endoscopic ultrasound, but it can be an adjunctive tool for surveying patients. And I think the key thing is that it's done in the context of a screening program, and it's done in the context of understanding the broader implications for the family and what specific diseases run in that family.
Excellent, thank you. And one other question, which will be our last question, a question about weight gain and that feeling of fullness, if one could comment on that. And I wonder if Dr. Javle, if you could just comment on that, if we actually didn't address that in terms of weight.
So the question is why someone is gaining weight, is it?
Yeah, weight gain in the sense of fullness.
Oh, weight gain in the sense of fullness. So I think the problem with the sense of fullness in the stomach that arises in this cancer can be multifactorial. The most common one is lack of enzymes and having a high content of sugar and fat in the diet. But in the more when the cancer gets a little more advanced, it can be because the stomach is just slow, because the nerves around the stomach are being affected by the cancer. Or it may be that there's an actual obstruction at the lower end of the stomach, secondary to the growth in the cancer. So I think a careful history discussion with the with your provider would help to distinguish one versus another. Sometimes when it's not clear cut, we try enzymes, we try medications for improving the stomach function, and if they don't work, then we recommend a scope. They have a GI specialist get a scope of the stomach and make sure there is no real obstruction that needs to be alleviated.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been extraordinary. And I also want to thank all of you who've been on this conference call today. And I do want to say that this is an hour program and that we know that in planning a program like this, that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want you to know that if you didn't get to ask a question or think of a question in a couple of days, do call us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. But also, I don't want anyone to leave the call feeling that you're alone in coping with pancreas cancer or in dealing with cancer alone. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and we're here to help you. We have oncology social workers here, people who are willing to talk with you and discuss your concerns. We have support groups, workshops like this. Indeed, we do have a workshop coming up, actually, on managing cancer pain, which some of you might be interested in. It's actually this Friday, May 31st. Same time as this program, and so please do, it's in your materials if that might be of interest to you. We also have materials and fact sheets, and we also offer practical and financial assistance. Most importantly, please do take advantage of these free services to help you to cope, and I also want to just thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.